Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty, reporting. At least 44 people were killed and hundreds more injured by a series of enormous explosions at a hazardous materials warehouse in the northeastern Chinese port city of Tianjin late Wednesday. Pictures and video showed gigantic plumes of fire and a mushroom cloud that dwarfed nearby high-rise buildings and sent a massive shockwave that rattled residents several kilometers from the blast site. Aerial footage posted Thursday by the official Xinhua News Agency showed a still-smoldering center of destruction. Hundreds of firefighters are trying to contain the blaze. State media say at least 32 people remain in critical condition after the explosions. At least 400 people were injured. The United States says it has begun flying unmanned missions from a Turkish air base to deliver airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Syria. The Pentagon released a statement Wednesday saying that the F-16 airstrikes began earlier that day, launched from an airbase in southern Turkey. Coalition began flying unmanned missions from the base earlier this month. Turkey agreed last month to let U.S. forces use the airbase near Turkey's southern border with Syria. Myanmar's President Thein Sein carried out a purge of the leadership of the country's ruling party Thursday in a major political shakeup ahead of national elections in November. The party released a statement saying that Union Solidarity and Development Party chairman Shui Man was removed from post because his duties as both a party leader and a parliamentary speaker were too much of a burden. Officials said Shui Man will remain as parliament speaker and as a party candidate in the upcoming polls. This is VOA News. The next phase of the historic normalization of U.S.-Cuba shifts to Havana Friday, where the U.S. Marines will hoist the American flag outside of the U.S. Embassy in Havana. The event marks the ceremonial reopening of the diplomatic facility after decades of severed relations. Ahead of the ceremony, the U.S. is deflecting criticism about dissidents and not involving dissidents in the official ceremony. Spokesman Mark Toner for the U.S. State Department.
As much as we look forward to increasing our diplomatic engagement with the government of Cuba, we're well aware of the challenges that we face on the human rights sphere, and we're not going to shy away from addressing those challenges and continuing to meet with key members of civil society in Cuba.
Some of the discontent with U.S. plans in Havana are homegrown. U.S. Congressman Ileana Rosleitinen.
What the administration is doing is sending a message to the dissidents that they form no role in this new relationship between the United States and Cuba, that they are forgotten, they are discarded.
A U.S. official says there would be a second, larger ceremony later in the day at the residence of Ambassador Jeffrey De Laurentiis, the U.S. chief of missions, including political and human rights activists. Pakistan and Afghanistan held high-level meetings Thursday in an attempt to ease tensions between them following a series of terror attacks in Kabul that have killed scores of people. An Afghan delegation led by Foreign Minister Salahuddin Rabbani met with Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif in Islamabad and held separate talks at Pakistan's foreign ministry, officials said. Mr. Sharif's office issued a brief statement noting that matters relating to bilateral relations and mutual interest came under discussion, but no other details were released before the Afghan visitors returned to Kabul late Thursday. Nigeria's president has ordered the military to defeat the Boko Haram insurgency within 3 months. President Muhammadu Buhari spoke in Abuja Thursday as he swore in 4 new military chiefs. The president replaced the heads of the Army, Navy, Air Force, and his chief of defense soon after taking office May 29th in an effort to re-energize the fight against Boko Haram. Greek lawmakers are expected to vote later Thursday on a bill to approve a $93 billion bailout package from the European Union. The bill would impose harsh new spending cuts and tax hikes in exchange for funding that will enable Athens to make a payment on its debt to the European Central Bank later this month. Greece needs the money by August 20th, when it must repay about $3.5 billion in debt to the European Central Bank. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
I perceive that it's like people who are used to as free spirits, and then you ask them to take them into a camp situation. They will always resist that. To them, they feel that maybe they are enclosed.
That's Gift Lapozo, the district commissioner for Mwanza District in Malawi. He talks about his country's support for displaced people from Mozambique. Details coming up. Also in the news, the president of Chad says Boko Haram may have a new leader willing to negotiate with Nigeria for an end to the militant's 6-year reign of terror. And Human Rights Watch criticizes discrimination against the Batwa community in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Jonah Haskell sitting in for Sunny, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon dismissed the head of the UN peacekeeping mission in the Central African Republic, MINUSCO, after the latest of many allegations of sexual abuse and excessive use of force by members of peacekeeping mission in Bangui, the capital. Mr. Ban says he has accepted the resignation of General Babacar Gaye of Senegal today. The general's resignation was requested by the UN Secretary General shortly after Amnesty International reported that MINUSCA troops raped a 12-year-old girl and killed a boy and his father in an operation this month in Bangui. Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF or Médecins Sans Frontières, says it has treated 4 cases of sexual abuse of minors by peacekeepers in the past year. A UN spokesman says there have been 57 allegations of misconduct reported since MINUSCA forces arrived in April 2014, including 11 cases of possible sexual abuse. The spokesman said those cases were being investigated. Only local governments have authority to prosecute charges against peacekeepers. Mr. Ban says they should be brought to justice in accordance with their national laws. The behavior of peacekeepers recently came under fresh scrutiny due to charges of sexual abuse by soldiers from France, Chad, and Equatorial Guinea, prior to MINUSCA's creation. Some charged with use of excessive force have been sent home. Hundreds of Mozambicans have fled into Malawi because of fighting between government forces and the opposition party, RENAMO. As VOA's Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, many of the displaced people are shunning relocation to a refugee camp.
The Mozambicans started entering Malawi in early July after RENAMO fighters carried out 2 attacks in Tete province. RENAMO disputes the results of last year's elections and also autonomy in northern Mozambique, where it has the most support. The refugees are settling at Kapise 2 village in Malawi's southern district of Mwanza. Headman William Michiwe told VOA his village is hosting 777 Mozambicans so far. He says there are men, women and children, but they are living in appalling conditions, mainly because of lack of food and other basic necessities of their day-to-day life. Malawi's government has started to move the Mozambicans to a designated refugee camp in a neighboring district, Neno. Gift Lapozo is the district commissioner for Mwanza.
Over 119 of them were relocated to Luani camp, where they are properly being hosted by government of Malawi, with support from UNHCR and World Food Program.
But authorities say many of the Mozambicans are shunning relocation. Some flee into the bush if they see a Malawi government vehicle, while others conceal their identity. Some people staying in makeshift shelters at Kapise 2 this week denied being Mozambicans. They told VOA they were only visiting displaced Mozambican friends who at the time were away to do some peace work. Lapozo thinks those shunning the refugee camp don't want any form of confinement.
I perceive that it's like people who are used to as a free spirits, and then you ask them to take them into a camp situation, they will always resist that. To them, they feel that maybe they are enclosed.
One villager told VOA the refugees simply don't want to stay too far from the homes they left in Mozambique. Principal Secretary in the Ministry of Home Affairs and Internal Security, based on Chisamale, told local radio this week that resistance aside, the relocation effort is continuing.
What we have done as government is to tell them that they will be moved to a new site. So the ones that are indicating that they are ready to move, they are the ones that we are moving out.
The Luwani camp previously hosted Mozambicans who fled their country 16-year civil war between 1977 and 1992. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
A conflict between the Pygmy and Luba communities in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo appears to have been sparked by discrimination, according to Human Rights Watch. VOA's Nick Long has more from Goma in eastern DRC.
The United Nations reports hundreds of civilians have been killed in northern territories of the Democratic Republic of Congo's Katanga province since armed groups from the ethnic Batwa, or Pygmy, and Luba communities started launching large-scale attacks on each other's villages 2 years ago. Dozens of villages have been burned to the ground and tens of thousands of people displaced. Human Rights Watch recently interviewed survivors of one of the worst attacks when Luba fighters killed at least 30 Pygmies with machetes, arrows and axes in April at Nyunzu. The organisation has also spoken to Luba survivors of Pygmy attacks. In its report on the conflict released Tuesday, Human Rights Watch calls for DRC authorities with UN support to improve protection, investigate and prosecute those responsible for atrocities and address the communal tensions and discrimination, which it says appear to have sparked the fighting. The report says tensions between the two communities erupted in mid-2013 after Batwa demanded respect for their basic rights, including access to land and an end to alleged forced labour or a form of slavery. Spokesman for the UN mission in Congo, MONUSCO, Felix Bass, discussed the situation Wednesday.
Le conflit entre les Luba, les Balubakat et les Pygmées n'est pas un conflit.
The conflict between the Luba and the Pygmies is not recent, it is centuries old, Bass tells reporters. He says the two communities' coexistence has been troubled because of land disputes and claims to certain rights, and they have formed armed groups that clash repeatedly. The Human Rights Watch report says the government has primary responsibility for security in the area, but alleges MONUSCO has had too few troops based at Nyunzu. Bass rejected suggestions the mission has paid insufficient attention to this remote area.
Monsieur Martin Kobler s'était personnellement rendu à Nyunzu.
He says MONUSCO chief Martin Kobler personally visited Nyunzu to investigate the social situation there, which he says is deteriorating by the day.
À plusieurs reprises, la MONUSCO a déployé
MONUSCO has deployed troops at Nyunzu several times, he adds, including special forces and a temporary operational base to help restore calm, and that has been achieved. The United Nations says most of the estimated 15,000 displaced people at Nyunzu have returned to their villages, although many of their homes have been destroyed and living conditions are extremely difficult. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
The president of Chad says Boko Haram may have a new leader willing to negotiate with Nigeria for an end to the militant 6-year reign of terror. President Idris Deby told Chad State Radio last night he has been told that a new leader of Nigeria's extremists named Mahamat Daoud is willing to discuss an end to the conflict in northern Nigeria. For several years, Boko Haram social media featured the face and claims of a man called Abubakar Shekau. Shekau achieved leadership of the Islamist sect in Nigeria 6 years ago when Nigerian police killed its leader, Muhammad Yusuf. Shekau turned the conservative religious movement into a violent gang of gunmen seeking to end Western influence in the region. However, Shekau has not appeared in the group's online communications for many months. Some observers of the conflict argue that the militants do not have a central leadership. Others believe Shekau is dead. Mr. Deby, who tried negotiating with Boko Haram once before, says he does not recommend a negotiation with an unknown Boko Haram leadership. Nigeria President Muhammadu Buhari has declared since his March election that he is willing to negotiate with Boko Haram. The group wants to create an Islamic caliphate of three states in northern Nigeria. It has kidnapped hundreds of school children, killed thousands of Muslims and Christians, and waged a war that displaced more than 1.5 million Nigerians. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon dismisses the head of the UN peacekeeping mission in the Central African Republic. And hundreds of Mozambicans have fled into Malawi because of fighting between government forces and the opposition party, RENAMO. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. A new study calls for urgent action to integrate anti-smoking strategies into tuberculosis, HIV, and TB-HIV care. The International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease released a report this week that identifies critical missed opportunities in TB and HIV programs. Smoking and exposure to secondhand smoke are known to exacerbate these diseases. Dr. Angela Jackson-Morris is the lead author of the study. She spoke to my colleague Kim Lewis about the urgency to include anti-smoking measures in TB treatment programs.
For some years, the union and other organizations have attempted to get the message across that TB and HIV care must start to incorporate the anti-smoking strategies. We know that more people who smoke end up having TB. Treatment is less effective. We know that there are more smokers amongst people with TB and HIV. And we know that treatment, again, for antiretroviral therapy is less effective if people smoke. So we see this as critical because, in a sense, we are failing patients if we are just treating them but not preventing this ultimately preventable issue that will stop them living a good quality of life with HIV or getting better from TB if they continue to smoke. And the issue applies as well if they're exposed to secondhand smoke in the home.
In your study, you point out some practical measures that you recommend to be incorporated into treatment programs. What are some of those measures?
There are things like monitoring whether the patients that you see are smokers or ex-smokers, are still smoking, so that you can then follow up with them and the other healthcare workers can provide appropriate support. It's making sure that you've got, for example, a smoke-free environment, so a smoke-free healthcare facility, a smoke-free hospital, and also the workers who see patients at home, encouraging family members to not smoke in the home or around the patient and explaining to them that effectively their loved one, their family member, won't get better from TB and won't be successful on their antiretroviral therapy if they've still got this secondhand smoke around them. So that's important. And a critical one, I think, as you would expect, would be cessation. That would be working with patients, so identifying who is still smoking and giving them the appropriate support to stop. Another thing that is an issue that we see in some healthcare environments is where managers can be under pressure from tobacco industry representatives, for example, to take sponsorship. So again, it would be making sure with the hospital managers, the healthcare facility managers, that that kind of thing doesn't happen. And that way people aren't inadvertently exposed to tobacco advertising when they go, for example, to their local clinic, which would be anathema to what the healthcare workers are trying to do for the patients and their families.
You also emphasize it's important that urgent action is needed in integrating these anti-smoking strategies. So how would you go about getting this accomplished, say, for instance, in countries in Africa?
I think The paper is a start. What we're trying to do is to reach particularly TB and HI practitioners and just get the message across to them that we do not see this as being a complex thing to integrate into their day-to-day work. We know that they're busy. We know that they see many patients, and costs are an issue. And that's why these strategies, we know, will be more effective. It will help them in their duty of care to the patients and their families in terms of being more effective in getting patients better. So what we would suggest is that the paper is a start in getting the message out there. What we're going to be doing, what the union is doing in the countries in which we work in, and other countries, WHO, is now working harder to try and get this message across so that people, for example, in charge of hospitals, healthcare facilities, take a lead on making their healthcare environment smoke-free, that individual practitioners get together and identify how in the treatment and the care process they will work to identify smoking patients, to give them the advice and the support to stop and to do the same at home with their families.
That was Dr. Angela Jackson-Morris. She is the lead author of the study on anti-smoking strategies for the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease. She spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis from Edinburgh, United Kingdom. It's been a year since Michael Brown, an African-American youth, was killed by police officer Darren Wilson in the small Midwestern city of Ferguson, Missouri. The incident set off weeks of protests and some violence in Ferguson and other American cities. Protesters say that police routinely target blacks and often brutalize them. There was more unrest when a grand jury declined to charge Wilson with a crime. VOA's Adam Phillips paid a visit to Harlem, New York's iconic African-American district, to ask people what, if anything, has changed in police-minority relations since Ferguson and what a way forward might be.
It's lunch hour on 125th Street, and Buddy Barrett, an older African-American man sporting a stylish mix of African jewelry and American clothes, is waiting for a bus, so he's got some time to talk to a reporter about Ferguson's legacy and racism.
There have been some appeasing to sort of ease down the racial friction, but it is my belief you can't change what's in a man's heart. I know we can't continue on the course that we're on. Something has to happen. First of all, people are not ignorant anymore. We're mad as hell. We ain't gonna take this crap no more.
Danelle is also mad as hell. She says cops continue to treat black lives as less precious than their own.
It ain't gonna get no better. Long as the police department feel that, you know, if you're not a cop, your life don't mean. And I would never make my feel like my life is lesser than theirs because they wear a badge. Like when one of them die, they want the whole world to stop and moan. No, I'm not doing that. If you're not doing that for a regular citizen, why should we do it for y'all? No, you can't sugarcoat it. This is reality.
One criticism of current police practice is that the police that patrol the local streets are psychologically far too removed from the communities they serve. Indeed, many New York City police officers live outside the city itself. Danelle says this fortress mentality contrasts with police practices in place during her girlhood in the 1960s.
I remember back in the days, we knew who our neighborhood cop was. We had a problem, we went to him. He knew us, he knew the neighbors, he knew our name. These cops is not trying to get familiar. And what they need to start doing, like they said they was going to do, any cop that work wherever they work at, they need to live there. Let them live around where they work at. I bet you'll change then.
Hamid and Kenji have been married for 27 years. The VOA caught up with them outside a busy supermarket where they were hoping for some bargains.
A year later, so what's your opinion? I mean, is it better or worse? What's your comment?
I believe, you know, people have to change in order for situations to change. I mean, you can put all different things in place. You know, you can chastise the police. You know, you can put services in the community. You know, you can talk about it, have all the community meetings you want. However, if people don't change the way they think, then the problem's still going to exist.
And how do they think, in your view?
Bias, unjust, unfair, you know, one-sided. But situation like Ferguson, it goes both ways. You know, you have to speak with the youth about respect. Parents have to do their job and be parents. And at the same time, police have to understand that they're not just in the community to enforce the law, but to communicate, you know, to bridge the gap, teamwork, stakeholders, you know, together we stand, you know, so you in the community to help the community, to educate, to guide, to lead, as well as to enforce when you have to. You know, you try to work together and see how you can help each other. Then you may make change. But if it stays where it's a separate, the police, I'm here to enforce, the community, I don't care nothing about you, then it's going to quiet down until the next incident uproar.
Well, I agree with my husband. It's basically on how people think, and it begins at home. Everything starts at home with the respect, with the loyalty, with the dignity. You can't buy the dignity of a man. That's got to be taught at home. And if you don't teach them at home, they're going to bring chaos in the street.
Yeah, but like a lot of these young people would say, well, you're blaming the victim here. I mean, I'm just minding my own business, sitting on the steps with my friends.
Well, there are situations where negativity came towards them. But those who are out here breaking the law have to start standing up and acknowledging their wrongdoing and stop the name blame. Yes, we were suppressed, and at times we still are suppressed, but people got to learn to start taking responsibility of what their downfalls or their negativity that they contribute to the situation.
Raymond Williams agrees, but with this twist. He says that in a fundamental sense, police and community members, white and black, are connected. That's the bad news and the good news.
And the only way we're going to survive this is if we come together as a people, as Americans. I don't care about religion or race. We are human beings. And we got to come together as human beings in order to change the situation. We can't just say, oh, that's a black problem, that's a white problem. It's a human problem.
A sampling of opinions in Harlem about race relations 1 year after Ferguson. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
President José Mário Vaz has dismissed the government of Guinea-Bissau. The move comes after growing differences with his prime minister, Domingos Simoes Pereira. Mr. Vaz is an economist and former finance minister. He has shared power with Pereira since defeating a candidate backed by the military in a 2014 election that ended military rule. The president cited a breach of trust in announcing the immediate dismissal of Pereira and his cabinet. However, the EU urges local political forces to overcome differences that could jeopardize billions of dollars in much-needed development aid. Good wishes are pouring in for former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who is being treated for cancer. Carter said the unnamed cancer has spread to other parts of his body. Mr. Carter, who is 90, announced yesterday the disease was discovered earlier this month during surgery to remove a mass on his liver. President Barack Obama spoke to Mr. Carter late yesterday and wished him a full and speedy recovery. Mr. Carter expects to release a more complete public statement about his cancer once more facts are known. Since leaving the Oval Office in 1981, the former president has been hailed as a global humanitarian. He has written several books, including his latest, A Full Life, Reflections at 90. This is African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one I judge, this one I judge.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover.
meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon dismisses the head of the UN peacekeeping mission in the Central African Republic. And hundreds of Mozambicans have fled into Malawi because of fighting between government forces and the opposition party, RENAMO. Coming up, music from Ghana. And in our feature segment, a Nigerian artist who uses his art to help build relationships in his community attends a summit meeting with President Obama in Washington, D.C. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Jonah Haskell sitting in for Sunny. Hello, Jonah.
Hello, Yehiz.
What's going on in the sports world this evening?
Well, we begin today in Canada, where the Canadian Open begins its third round on Thursday. Wednesday was the first day of competition that was not interrupted by rain, as all scheduled matches were played and all suspended matches from previous days were made up. Many big names were in action on Wednesday, with most of them moving on, but there were also a few upsets. 15th-seeded Gaël Monfils was eliminated by Luxembourg's own Gilles Muller, 6-3, 3-6, 7-6, and 5th-seed Thomas Berdych lost to unseeded American Donald Young, 7-6, 6-3. Also, 6th-seed Marin Cilic was knocked out by Bernard Tomic, while Gilles Simon, seeded 9th, was beaten by Mikhail Huzny of Russia in a match that ended 6-1, 6-4. Stan Wawrinka, the 3rd-seed in Montreal, went into the third set against Nick Kyrgios, but had to retire due to injury with the score at 6-7, 6-3, 4-0. There was controversy during the match when Kyrgios was heard making a derogatory comment about Wawrinka's girlfriend in between points. The comment followed an exchange between the two players from the point before, where Wawrinka complained that Kyrgios was wasting time. Media and most of the tennis establishment were quick to criticize Kyrgios for his comments, but he did not have much of an answer when asked to explain his actions.
You know, I thought, he was getting a bit lippy at me, so I don't know, it's just in the moment sort of stuff. I didn't really know. I just said it.
Some called for Kyrgios to be suspended or fined for his actions, but judgment has yet to be laid down. As of now, Kyrgios is expected to play John Isner in the third round later Thursday. Getting back to the tennis, last year's Canadian Open winner Joe Wilfried Tsonga advanced as he defeated Roberto Bautista Agut in a tight match, 5-7, 7-6, 7-5, and the unseeded Jeremy Chardy also moved on to the third round after he dispatched Leonardo Mayer, 4-6, 7-6, 6-2. David Goffin, Kei Nishikori, and John Isner were also victorious on Wednesday, while 14th-seeded Grigor Dimitrov was ousted by Jack Sock, who moved on with a 5-7, 7-6, 7-5 win. Former world number one Rafael Nadal, who has had a rough year so far, also moved on, defeating Sergei Stakhovsky, 7-6, 6-3, in his first match since winning the International German Open last week. Before his match, Nadal spoke about the importance of that win and his outlook going forward.
Well, it has been a positive week for me, obviously. A victory always is a victory, and at the same time, I have been very happy the way that I played in terms of tennis, but especially in terms of mentality. You know, I have been more stable than what I have been during the first 6 months of this season, and that's an important deal for me.
Moving to Toronto, where the women are playing, we also saw several upsets. Third seed and world number four Petra Kvitova crashed out of the tournament against unseeded Victoria Azarenka, 6-2, 6-3. And seventh seed Lucy Safarova, who reached the French Open final this year, lost a close match to Russian Daria Gavrilova, 4-6, 7-5, 7-5. Former world number one Caroline Wozniacki, who is seeded fourth in Toronto, also lost. She went out in straight sets to Switzerland's Belinda Bencic, 7-5, 7-5. But there was some sanity in the results, as 6th seed Agnieszka Radwanska defeated Julia Georges, and 2nd seed Simona Halep made short work of Jelena Jankovic, 6-3, 6-4. Halep, who has not played great recently but has had success on hard court before, spoke about her past experience in Toronto and her goals in Canada.
I'm happy to be back here. I played once in Toronto and I played well. I had my biggest winning at that time against Kuznetsova. I played well here and I'm really happy that I came back to play this tournament because it's a nice tournament. I feel confident that I'm back on hard court because at the beginning of the year I had good results. But still, I'm coming after one difficult period, so I'm trying just to take my confidence back and just to feel like, that I'm enjoying the tennis on court.
Anna Ivanovic also advanced after defeating Olga Gvortsova, and England's Heather Watson was eliminated with a loss to Andrea Petkovic of Germany. Also advancing were Sara Errani, Roberta Vinci, Angelique Kerber, and Sabine Lisicki. The third round of the Canadian Open will continue on Friday.
Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237.
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner at UA. VOA. And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
The Voice of America, VOA.
The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma joins us now with sports news from all over the continent, and I believe he's beginning today with handball.
Egypt dismissed Venezuela 51-28 to clinch their first victory at the Men's Youth World Handball Championships in Yekaterinburg, Russia, on Wednesday, while Switzerland beat Algeria 30-21. Today, Thursday, Tunisia encounters Argentina. Turning to netball, hosts Australia outplayed South Africa 66-31 at the Netball World Cup in Sydney on Wednesday. The world champions New Zealand prevailed over Malawi 57-49. Today, Thursday, Uganda engages Jamaica. In swimming, South African Olympic 200-meter butterfly champion Chad Leclos aims to set two world records at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Leclos is quoted in the official Olympic online news bulletin rio2016.com on Wednesday. Leclos declared his goal is to break American Michael Phelps' 100-meter and 200-meter butterfly world records, which stand at 49.82 seconds and 1 minute and 51.51 seconds, respectively. Moving on to football, A Confederation of African Football CAF inspection team is to visit Rwanda from the 23rd to 27th August to assess their preparation to stage the Orange African Nations Championships, CAF revealed in Cairo, Egypt. The draws for the competition takes place in the Rwanda capital, Kigali, on the 18th of November, while the three-week contest kicks off on the 16th of January next year. Meanwhile, Tunisia will host Libya in a friendly football match in Tunis today, Thursday. Finally, in rugby, defending champions Namibia host Zimbabwe in a Confederation of African Rugby Division 1A Africa Cup tie in Windhoek on Saturday. Whoever prevails in this match will win the Africa Cup for this year.
Thank you very much. That's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. We move now to the Midwestern U.S. town of Kohler, Wisconsin, where the 2015 PGA Championship, the last major of the year, just got underway on Thursday morning. Rory McIlroy, currently ranked number one in the world, is back after missing the British Open with an ankle injury. McIlroy won the PGA Championship last year and will be looking for a repeat, although he has yet to take the course, and neither has Jordan Spieth, who has been the best golfer in the world this year but is still chasing McIlroy for the number one ranking. Before teeing off, Spieth spoke about his goal of becoming number one and holding on to that ranking.
When that was a goal, that was just a career goal. At one point in my career, I'd like to be. Given everything that's happened, I believe now that, you know, I'd like it, obviously, to be sooner rather than later and then to be able to hold on to it. That's a whole other animal, as I'm sure, you know, Rory knows, Adam Scott knows, Luke Donald knows, there's Tiger. These guys that are in this field, Martin Keimer, there's a Vijay, there's a number of them that understand what it's like. I don't know what that feels like yet. That'll be a new goal if I can accomplish the one prior at some point in my career.
Spieth and Johnson will be teeing off along with British Open winner Zach Johnson later on Thursday. Several players are already deep into their first rounds, though. The current leader is Thomas Bjorn of Denmark, who is 5-under through 13 holes. Three golfers are tied for second at 4-under, and that includes Hideki Matsuyama, Matt Jones, and Dustin Johnson. Johnson, who is American, has been known throughout his career for getting off to strong starts, but then fading as tournaments reach the later rounds, including earlier this year when Johnson three-putted on the final hole of the U.S. Open to hand the crown to Spieth. Before starting his round, Johnson spoke about how his constant drop-offs have affected him.
I don't really get too angry about them, but yeah, definitely motivation for sure. It's frustrating sometimes, but I try not to let it bother me. You know, I love the game, and at the end of the day, it is just a game, and we're out here playing for all of you and all the fans, and to get upset and get too worked up about it, I think is not worth it. So I try to learn from all of the things that's happened and you know, move forward and help me the next time I'm in the situation to overcome it and get a major championship.
The first Africans on the leaderboard are Louis Oosthuizen and Mark Grace, who sit three shots back at 2-under. Other famous names on the course right now are Ricky Fowler, Martin Keimer, and Jason Day, who are all at 2-under, while Ernie Els and Justin Rose find themselves at 1-under. Tiger Woods has managed to stay even through eight holes, and Jeff Ogilvie, Carl Schwartzel, and Vijay Singh are clustered together at 1-over. The PGA Championship will continue on Friday and through the weekend, with the winner being named Sunday. And that does it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Jonah Haskell. Back to Yehias Wuhib.
Thank you, Jonah. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, a Nigerian artist who uses his art to help build relationships in his community at a summit meeting with President Obama in Washington, D.C. And next, the depreciation of the local Malawi currency, the kwacha, against major foreign currencies. But first, some music. Here is Mr. Aduro of Ghana with Abiba.
Mayada, macheke, mayada, macheke, mayada, macheke, mayada.
Abiba,
Abiba,
Abiba, Abiba, very good Abiba, very good Abiba, juju me Abiba,
Macheke,
Korisa Abiba, Yerosa Abiba,
Macheke.
Jerry Bordrow, and through NTRP and DC law, Yenya Clinton near the Yako High Court, President Sekoa at 2CSO, you and you are. Give me some more. The dead that's a tea pamper and it's raw. To start with the Ghana, you win the raw. Defend this or say for any football. Me what did you see? Me pay me support. Miss Lamina so. Take tall. No be no commentary. You be a flaw. Grab your grab and your draw. Auntie your rubber. Put on, put off. Miss Abiba. Try hardcore. H, H, H.
Abiba, hey, Abiba. Abiba, hey.
Faina mama, mi babe so udo mi yo pa me duncha. Mi kende bi debi, danchi bi yuma. Uni makume mu imani me ni susruma pa. Sabra che adiza yo baba. Ni nante ni ni kasa kwa ma fanela. Ni ni kumi kwa ni 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 nwa ma. Ma, ma, ah, ah, ah. Show, adu wa mi wa ma unu ensanda. Mi ba me besu wa udo ni sa sindia.
Apuanya misubani a raw raw draws, you so cruel, why you dangerous? Past them one, create me come across. Me don't need so say I believe was. Me ye wakume mo boss, obi stem ya kan, na mi di ni cause. Me wo physical cross, me in tongue draws. Hey me ambe cars, my name is Thor. When they was Caesar, farmer Caesar, na me your domo bleeder. Na me huwa puta we say class one teacher. Papa pa, touch my dear say Roman sister. O C P word, O Cita. Paul Amarte, Mwasini Pita. Bruta, Tepela, the network, Akaida. Hali, 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 Mr. Duro, Beta.
Abiba, eh, Abiba. Abiba, eh, Abiba. Eh, very good, Abiba.
Bayada.
Very good, Abiba.
Bacheki.
Juju me, Abiba.
Bayada.
Konsa, Abiba.
Bacheki.
Yeno, sa, Abiba.
Bayada.
Konsa, Abiba.
Bayada.
Mr. Oduro of Ghana with Abiba. In its second year, President Barack Obama's Young African Leader Initiative welcomed dozens of young Africans as Mandela Washington Fellows. They came to the U.S. for 6 weeks to study at U.S. universities and a summit meeting with President Obama in Washington, D.C. Among them is Alakunle Adewale, a Nigerian artist who uses his art to help build relationships in his community back home in Lagos. Here he is in his own words.
My name is Kunle Adewale from Nigeria. I'm studying civic leadership at Tulane University as part of YALI program for 2015. I'm an artist. I'm also an art educator. I teach in schools, teaching kids, and I work in the community with non-governmental organizations through art therapy, art workshops, by engaging the people in the community. So that's part of what I do there in Lagos, Nigeria. I think that art has a relationship with building the community because art connects to everything around us. Art can be used for activism, art can be used for advocacy, and I think that art also connects to politics. Art can be used as a voice for the voiceless. Art can be used as a tool for the helpless. Art can be used for empowerment for the downtrodden.
One, two, three, teamwork!
Make teamwork!
I applied to YALI because I want to be a better leader. And I also know that YALI has opportunity of connecting me with people, professionals who are in this field, and who will be able to mentor me and guide me to achieving more with my programs in Nigeria. I have opportunity of driving around New Orleans, and for me, it was an awesome moment.
seeing the mural painting and trying to learn about how the environment is being represented in art. I've been able to see how art connects to history, how art has been used to immortalize people, how art is used to educate people, how art is used to preserve history. Today we visited Whitney Plantation here in Louisiana. I was disturbed, I was in pain, I was crying because these people had no power to free themselves. Nobody could come to their rescue. They were here working day and night, and in the process they lost their lives. And for me, this is a moment of emotion for me that I can't really control. I hope the government will continue to fight anything that promotes slavery in any kind, in any form. I hope the government will be able to stop it.
This painting is specially for President Barack Obama because he is my hero. Yes, we can. That's the title of the painting. I believe that alone we can do little, but together we can accomplish more. So I've been able to integrate how the United States of America is empowering Africa, a collaboration program to help young leaders in Africa develop their potential to the fullest and see how they can impact their community.
That was Mandela Fellow Alakonde Adewale of Lagos, Nigeria. In Malawi, economists say the depreciation of the local currency, the kwacha, against major foreign currencies would likely result in sharp price increases for commodities. Figures from various local commercial banks show the kwacha dropped by an average of 10% in July alone. Within the month, the currency dropped 11.1% against the U.S. dollar and 12% against the euro. It also dropped by 11.5% to a British pound and 8.2% to the South African rand. Colleen Kalua is a local economist based in Blantyre. He speaks to VOA Islamic Messina on the cause of the depreciation and its impact on the lives of Malawians.
I think it has been a deliberate devaluation by the government to probably try to increase the forex, probably through the sales of the remaining tobacco. But it has been ill-timed because we have been advising the government to be devaluing the kwacha at the beginning of the tobacco sales season, not midway or probably three-quarter way through.
When you say it's ill-timed, what do you mean exactly?
Why? Because now the tobacco market is about to close. Unless if the government is going to extend the selling of tobacco probably to end September, then gains might be reaped there. But now, at the end of the day, the benefits might be lower than the cost that might come with this devaluation later.
So what impact is the depreciation of the kwacha has on the economy?
The impact will be there very shortly, because now what it means in economics, devaluation is an import tax. So whoever imports from outside into Malawi now will be paying higher tax, and that now that is going to be inflationary. It will increase the prices of commodities in the country.
But some commentators say it's surprising that the depreciation is coming at a time when Malawi has recorded high levels of foreign reserves. Are you also surprised?
It might be surprising to others, but those who affected the policy probably they landed to increase those reserves more than they have right now. So I think if the idea is to add more foreign exchange, then that is acceptable. But if it was done without consultation, then that's very unfortunate.
But what impact will it have on the people on the ground?
On the ground, the impact might be the next importation of fuel. When fuel runs out with the kwacha devalued as it is, then it means the cost of fuel will go up, and that also now it has a material effect. It will affect each and every sector of the economy in the country.
So what do you think should be done to prevent the effect of the depreciation of the local currency on the lives of people?
What I think should be done is government should let the kwacha to its original value where it was before they devalued it. And actually, they should stop tampering with the kwacha. They should leave it to be the way it was, a flexible exchange rate. It really is determined by the market forces.
That was Colleen Kalua, an economist based in Blantyre. He spoke to VOA's Lamek Masina on the cause and the impact of the fall of the kwacha. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum. Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Human trafficking or modern slavery happens everywhere. No country is immune to it. And today, more than 20 million men, women, and children are enslaved worldwide. Every year, the United States Department of State issues its annual Trafficking in Persons Report, which evaluates the efforts of 188 countries and territories, including the United States, to fight modern slavery. They are not compared to other countries. Instead, they are evaluated based on their own efforts to comply with minimum standards for the elimination of human trafficking set forth in U.S. law. These standards are closely linked to the international agreement called the UN Palermo Protocol, which establishes an international framework to address human trafficking. Those countries with governments that fully comply with the standards fall into Tier 1. Countries that do not comply but are making significant efforts to do so are on Tier 2. The Tier 2 watch list includes countries that do not comply with the minimum standards and are making significant efforts, but failed to increase such efforts compared to the previous year, have a number of trafficking victims that is significant or significantly increasing, or who make commitments to take additional steps over the ensuing year to better address human trafficking. Finally, countries on Tier 3 do not comply with the minimum standards and are not making significant efforts to do so. According to the report, in 2014, 18 countries moved up in the tier rankings, while the same number dropped in the tier rankings. 31 countries are in Tier 1, 89 countries in Tier 2. The Tier 2 watch list contained 44 countries, and 23 countries comprise Tier 3. The TIP report is a valuable diplomatic tool because it helps hold governments accountable for taking real steps to end the scourge of modern slavery, said Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. Not only do foreign governments look to its recommendations on how to improve, civil society relies on these pages to guide their efforts as well. The U.S. government anti-trafficking policy and strategy similarly stem from this report, as do the efforts of many international organizations, said Undersecretary Sewell. The purpose of this document is not to scold and it's not to name and shame. It is to enlighten and to energize, and most importantly, to empower people, said Secretary of State John Kerry at the report's July 27th launch ceremony. Indeed, it is a call to action.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America, VOA.